Good morning. Whoa. How are you? Welcome Thursday morning to Tech Ed, last day. Who's seen every session they could see? Great, awesome. So we're going to talk this morning about APS, the Microsoft Analytics Platform System, affectionately known as SQL Server in a Box, Big Data in a Box, as Satya launched us about a month ago. I'll tell you a little bit about myself. We'll kind of walk through the basics of APS. We'll talk a little bit about Hadoop, scaling out SQL Server. I'll show you some demos on actually how this thing works, and I'll take questions at the end. So that's kind of the basics of how we'll walk through. So start with a little bit about me. I'm a senior program manager in the engineering team for PDW, formerly PDW, the Parallel Data Warehouse, now called APS. I spent about 9 years at Microsoft, worked in various divisions kind of all over the company, kind of seen a lot of things, done a lot of different things. Prior to that, I've worked at Amazon. Started my career at Deloitte Consulting, late 90s, early 2000s, did the startup thing. So I've kind of seen a bunch of different stuff, done a bunch of different stuff. So really, what's APS about? And how's the data warehousing model changing? And what you can see here is Gartner has talked about this being kind of a tipping point or an inflection point with data warehousing. And over the last 20, 30, 40 years, data warehousing has followed a traditional model. Very large appliances, very kind of static data models, you know, lots of star models, those kinds of things. And really what's changed in the last couple of years is that data warehousing is being asked to do things in ways that it's never been asked to before. You have the ever kind of changing model of the traditional data warehousing. And so specifically, there's a couple different ways that data warehousing today doesn't work. There's a lot of ways that this model can break. And this is a typical representation of a data model for a data warehouse, right? You have some static OLTP, ERP, CRM-type data sources. You shove that up through an ETL job into a data warehouse, and then you have some analytics on top of it. But that model's gone away. In the last 5-10 years, what's really evolved is kind of a very large increase in data volumes. There's plenty of talks about data volumes being expanded over the next 5 to 10 years, in the magnitudes of 10 to 15 to 20 to 100 to 150 to 200x, depending on who you talk to. There's a need for real-time data. So who doesn't expect now that Twitter doesn't update almost immediately when something's retweeted or somebody adds as a new user? So this idea of real-time data, having access to things that are happening in real-time or near real-time, is something that's very vital to businesses as they move forward. Then there's new data types. Oops, hit the wrong button. New data types and sources. So you have things like Twitter. You have things like Internet of Things, kind of the new buzzword of today, all the devices that are connected to the Internet. Sensors, web click data, inferred data, all kinds of things that are typical non-structured type data sources that you would get in a system. And then finally you have kind of cloud-borne data, things that are coming out of systems that are run in the cloud. So, online sites, transaction systems, Facebook, Twitter, all these social sites, Clout, Instagram, those kinds of things where companies are looking at getting kind of interactive feedback with their customers coming from places that don't necessarily have a traditional kind of sense in the way that a business is run. So really this evolves into what we call the modern data warehouse. And this is kind of something that we talk about a lot at Microsoft. And it really is based on a couple of key different layers. So there's really kind of four different trends that we talk about. Kind of at the top, starting our way down, is really kind of the BI and analytics, being able to expose data to customers, end users, in many different fashions. No longer it's just a static SQL Server reporting services report. Instead, it's going to be, I get an alert on my phone that says, hey, we're seeing web traffic kind of being changed on our site, or we're seeing a trend happening on the East Coast on something that maybe we need to want to react to on the West Coast as it evolves through the course of the day. The ability to get data in a bunch of different places, so being able to pull it from, traditional kind of single query models through ETL, through data qualities, but the concept of master data management, and being able to single source pieces of data throughout your company, and being able to merge that into traditional data warehousing models, as well as your OLTP and your online systems. And then there's kind of the data management and processing. We've already obviously talked about relational database. Those are, your traditional SQL Server type models. But really kind of the non-relational models really becoming a prevalent thing. The prevalence of Hadoop and other kind of non-SQL or NoSQL type data sources for data warehousing and structuring of data to pull it into a common data lake or environment where it's accessible, as well as other types of things that are now becoming prevalent. So streaming data, things coming from, like Twitter is a great example of streaming data, the fire hose of data coming out of Twitter. as well as other type of internal and external applications. And finally, again, back to those varied data sources. They're really coming from a lot of different locations, getting a lot of different data coming into a lot of different systems, and being able to make sense of that. So really, this really ties into kind of the way that you want to get insights out of your data. So really talking about kind of social and web analytics. There's not very many companies today that are really not looking at what's going on outside of their company. Data that's coming from the Facebooks of the world, the Twitters of the world, the Instagrams of the world, those kinds of places, where their customers are talking about their products or interacting with their products or exposed to their products in new ways, and really having some sense of how that analytic model is something that's of value to the company. So it's no longer looking at traditional point of sales type sales material, so you can figure out what's an intent from a customer, or how do you infer kind of sentiment about a product. Are people really happy about it, or are people really unhappy about your product? And you can only tell that by traditional sales data. Am I selling a lot of this thing? Am I not selling a lot of this thing? Instead, you can get that inference from all kinds of avenues, where people are posting pictures, where they're talking about your product, interactions in news forums or blogs. And so there's all kinds of ways that you can get all kinds of information that you don't have anymore, or that you didn't used to have. Live data feeds. So we talk about ways that people get access to data. There's all kinds of ways that this happens. So there's a great case study in the city of Barcelona, how they use, if you saw the keynote, where they talk about the bicing model and how they use the interactive information they get from kind of these live feeds about where bikes are being checked out of the city and where they're being returned in the city and how they see flow throughout the city. There's another great case study from Trek Bikes, where they're talking about having sensors information on the bicycles that they have for checkout in different cities across the world, and they're able to monitor how people flow through the city and the traffic that they can show, and what that does to kind of the businesses that they can expose that data to, as well as the partnerships they can make, the types of equipment they put in the city, the types of bicycles that they have. So if they see that most people are renting, a mountain bike that's got big shocks, but all they're doing is they're just riding around town, maybe that's not the appropriate bike, and they can make decisions based on what people are actually doing with the bikes instead of just making an assumption. And finally, advanced analytics. There's lots of companies that are looking at ways to go through DNA sequencing and being able to pull information from large-scale computer models and being able to push that into kind of advanced analytics, predictive analytics, being able to make assumptions about what's about to happen based on data and trends that you've seen in the past. And this is becoming an emerging field in kind of the data warehousing space. So really, we kind of talked about these, kind of some of the roadblocks to kind of traditional data warehouses and what some of these are stopping companies from being able to do. The first is kind of the limited scalability, the ability to handle new data types. So what happens when you get Twitter? How do you put that into some relational model that you can understand when you're getting hundreds of thousands or millions of records a second as to what's going on in the Twitter world? Twitter's a great example of kind of handling with this crazy set of volume of data that just kind of is constantly evolving, not something that you can just put into a schema somewhere and assume that it's going to stay that way for 5 or 10 years. You could stay that way for 5 or 10 minutes, to be honest. And you look at some of the big data solutions. So you talk about Hadoop, you talk about the MongoDBs, or the CouchDBs, or the RavenDBs, or some of these other systems. And you think about the kind of the training effort. One of the areas that those Hadoop specifically has suffered under for the last several years has been the model of having to switch people from something that they understand, T-SQL, or MySQL, or Oracle, something that they've understood for years, and having to retrain them and understand the languages of how to create workflows, how to create SQL jobs on top of Hadoop in a language that's unfamiliar. When you talk about kind of tier one appliances, specifically talking about APS here, you talk about kind of the acquisition cost and how many of these systems are built on very large scale, very high-end hardware, and they don't use the economies of scale that are available from hardware vendors. So you think about buying a set of servers, and you could buy one really big server, you could buy a commodity set of servers. And there's a push in the industry to move to a wider set of servers that you can scale compute out. This is the cloud model born without the word cloud around it, being able to scale out very quickly, very fast, but do it in an economical sense. And then finally, kind of business intelligence. There's a great metric, and it comes from tons of different sources. I'll cite Gartner here. That about 8% of the 8% of the use of tools, everything other than Excel, the adoption rate is about 8% across companies. It's widely cited. It's been referenced all over the place. Outside of Excel, people pretty much don't use the tools unless they have to. Inside of Excel, there's wide adoption of uses of Excel. Everybody basically says, Excel is the front end to every reporting system, every analytic systems in the world. And it's really true. So trying to understand how you use some of these advanced business analytics tools and turning that back into how do you make it accessible in Excel? How do you expose this data to Excel? How do you expose it to the users in the way that it makes sense to them? So really that introduces kind of the APS system. So the APS system is really, we call it big data in a box. That's kind of the term that's been associated with it. And really what it is, it's a combination of relational and non-relational database or data. It's built into a single system, so it's a reference architecture. It's defined. It shows up as a box. You don't have to pick and choose components. And it really incorporates a scale-out SQL Server component as well as an integrated Hadoop component. It has the ability to query across Hadoop as well as SQL Server using a technology called Polybase, which exposes Hadoop data as just plain T-SQL data that you can access. You can join it. You can insert data into it. You can pull data from it. And I'll show you that in a little bit. And it has, obviously, direct integration with all the Microsoft stacks, specifically Excel, but obviously all the other parts of the components of Microsoft, so SSAS, SSRS, and some of the other components. It talks about, really, the appliance working at very large scale. So inside of PDW, we're able to use kind of the components of SQL Server, things like in-memory computation through Hecaton, the CCI, so Clustered Column Index, the ability to look at an index vertically instead of horizontally, traditionally in indexing models. The way to scale out an appliance. So if you think about building out a very large database or a data warehouse built on top of SQL SMP, the traditional model had always been, I'm going to buy a really big server, and I'm going to buy a really big SAN, and I'm going to stick that in my data center. And if I outgrow that thing, what do? Well, I buy bigger SAN, and I buy bigger hardware. And what we found over the years is that model doesn't work. You eventually get to a point of saturation, and you see things like Hadoop, which have come across and said, well, I'm not going to do that. I could run Hadoop on, you know, 1,000 desktops sitting in a lab somewhere. It doesn't actually have to be enterprise-ready hardware. And so the APS system works in a very similar model. It uses commodity kind of mid-range hardware from our hardware partners, and it uses that as a scale-out model. We're able to distribute the computation across the model and scale very quickly. It removes a lot of the data warehouse kind of bottlenecks with MPP SQL Server, so the ability to very quickly load data. We don't have single points of failure where you say, I'm going to throttle through an additional control node and then I have to distribute out. We can actually use the power of multiple nodes, load data very quickly, compute very quickly, express data in a lot of different ways very fast by using the power of multiple nodes within the appliance. And finally, the ability to run concurrent operations on the environment. So you can have full-blown loads being happening on one side of the appliance while somebody's running very large-scale aggregations on the other side. And they're not blocking each other. The loads can be throttled depending on the needs of the business and not being throttled by the needs of the hardware. And finally, APS is an interesting play in that it's really engineered for optimal value. It has the least, or it has the lowest total cost of ownership of any of the appliance models that are out there. And it does it through a couple of different ways on how we achieve that. We'll talk about it a little bit later. But really it comes down to having kind of that commodity level hardware, being able to buy just servers that we would optionally see on any one of the major manufacturers' websites that we work with, and being able to pull those right into an appliance model through a static reference. So let's talk about Hadoop specifically. So really what is big data? And we're going to talk about kind of how this impacts the business. We'll talk about Hadoop specifically here. And I want to introduce this in a way so that you have a little bit of context around how APS works and how it integrates big data outside of just the traditional SQL Server model. So really what we used to see was the things down here in the orange box on the bottom, traditional kind of business-oriented line of business applications, so ERP systems, CRM systems, inventory management systems, those kinds of things. But really in the last several years, you've seen this explosion of growth. You see things that we see online, you know, the Web 2.0 model, right? All the mobile devices, all the things that you're getting out of the cloud, all of the sensor data that you're getting in all kinds of different information. And it's really blown out into what everybody now calls as big data, you know, clickstream data, things that are coming from the internet, things that you get from the devices that you have in your factories. Or you talk about major manufacturers. There's a really interesting case study around large-scale manufacturers who used to sell machinery, so forklifts and tractors and those kinds of things. And those models have changed. They've gone to leasing models. And so from a company's perspective, they're now looking at how do they optimize the value of that equipment? How do they extend its life? And so they put on all kinds of sensors. How long do the tires last? When are the hydraulic systems going to go out? So this kind of fuel of information. There's a great study. It came out a couple months ago done by Pew Research that talked about the Internet of Things. And it, at the beginning of this year, or at the end of last year, they cited that there were 13 billion Internet of Things devices. It's more than two per every human on the planet. And the idea is that each one of those things is emitting data. They call it the data exhaust, a term that Satya, our CEO, has used quite readily. And really what that means is that those things are emitting data about all kinds of things. You think of the applications that you have now that you never had before. The mapping data, the traffic data. So you're driving your car and your phone says, hey, there's an accident coming ahead. Take this side street instead to get around traffic. Those kinds of pieces of information are this large explosion of what's called big data. As it relates to companies, what this really means is that having access to that data means you can do all kinds of things that you couldn't do before. You can look at kind of historical analysis, you know, what do we do sales-wise, what do we do against our marketing campaigns, those kinds of traditional data warehousing models, and you can start to blow that out into what's the future of this. You can start to really do insight analysis. You can do inference models for things like sentiment value coming out of Twitter, how people are reacting to your product, how positive or how negative are things like a keynote at TechEd, how did Microsoft manage, monitor, and respond to whether people were happy with the keynote or not happy with the keynote. What kind of data could they gather? What kind of impressions could they get? And then you can start to make analysis and predictions about that. You can start to see, well, I'm seeing a trend, again, back to that bicycle example from the keynote. I see a trend of bicycles being checked out from this particular facility, and they're going to this particular facility. Maybe I need to set up some kind of system that pushes the bikes back into that system so that they show up at the place where people are actually using them. And you can start to make analysis on, well, it's going to be a big conference here at Houston, at TechEd, and historically we've had big conferences here, and this is what the hotels are going to look like, and this is what the cab needs, or the rental cars, and all those kinds of things. How am I going to plan for that as it comes forward? So you can look at the historical data and start to make inferences moving forward. In that model, the Office 365, it just introduced through the Q&A system, the ability in the last 2 weeks to look at the data that you have and make some assumptions about the predictions about what's about to happen. Do that based on the data that you've given it. And finally, kind of predictive forecasting, which is the next step of really kind of looking at predictive analytics. Being able to forecast not just 2, 3, 4 days in the future, but you know, 6 months in the future, a year in the future, and what those trends can look like based on the data that you're feeding the system. So let's talk about Hadoop a little bit. So I work for Microsoft. You know, take my biases, I work for Microsoft, but I'm very, very keen as to what's going on outside of Microsoft. My team in particular, we are partnered with a team inside of Microsoft, the Development Center, that actually produces HD Insight. They're one of our closest allies, and we spend a lot of time working on how does this work in the Microsoft world, as well as how do we contribute to the Hadoop world and make that product as useful to our customers as possible. We'd like it to be available to customers so that they could get at the data that they need in a way that makes sense for the data we represent it, not in a way that makes it make sense from the technology perspective. So how do you get your data? But let's take a step back and talk about what Hadoop is. So Hadoop is really just a simple file system. So HDFS, the Hadoop, and I can never remember what it is, Hadoop Distributed File System, is really just a commodity-level Java file system. It's Java-based, built on top of commodity hardware. And the idea was that we should build a file system that's easily accessible to throw anything we want into it and be able to get it out. And it can scale at massive scale, and it can be done very cheaply. That's always been the premise of Hadoop. It's composed of kind of a few parts. Obviously, I've simplified Hadoop down to 3 bullet points here. There are entire summits around Hadoop, so don't take my simplification here as anything other than I'm just trying to get it on a slide. But really, it's based on those three kind of common principles. There's the concept of HDFS as a storage layer on the bottom. There's the concept of MapReduce, which is a programming model for pushing jobs into the Hadoop environment and being able to do some kind of aggregation. And then finally, there's a set of tools built on top of that. So there's workflow tools, there's SQL on top, so tools like Scoop, there's Hive, which are workflow tools, and Pig, and those kinds of things, which are really, there's an entire industry built around building tools on top of Hadoop. In the last couple months, there's been a real trend for pushing into moving away from Hadoop and going into, moving away from MapReduce and going into kind of streaming models. So really getting away from kind of push-down predicates into the Hadoop system and really kind of getting at data in a little different way. But this is really kind of an industry that still hasn't evolved yet. It hasn't quite figured out some of the basic things that are really around building out data warehouses, building out accessibility to data, as well as the back to the basic problem we were talking about. Almost every user really wants to get at their data in Excel. Every metric has told us for years and years and years that the way that people are really getting at data, even people who work on top of Hadoop, really get at it through tools like Excel. So there's not really great stories about how do I just connect to data there, how do I pick the data I want, how do I just shove it into Excel and build a chart out so that I can give it to my boss to talk about what I have to do in my business. So what APS does with Hadoop is it delivers Hadoop as part of what we call a region. And we'll talk about this a bit in the next slide about how the regions lay out. But really what it is it means that the appliance itself is available to have the concept of structured or unstructured data. And it offers that through the ability to define a set of hardware that's dedicated to kind of structured data, so scale out SQL Server, or through which we call Parallel Data Warehouse, PDW, or through Hadoop. And so you could have both integrated inside a single appliance. They're connected through a technology called Polybase, which Microsoft built a few years ago. But really what this means is it gives you all the advantages of both technologies. It doesn't limit you to, oh, I want to choose structured data and come with the limitations of that. Or I want to choose unstructured data in Hadoop and I get the limitations of those. Instead, I get advantages of where I want to run my business. I want some data in structured business. I have my ERP, my line of business data, my HR data there. And I have my unstructured data, my web click data, the things I'm getting from my sensors and my devices, and being able to pull that into a way that actually makes sense to an end user. So how would I know what I've sold? Well, I can get that from my sales system. What are people looking for on my site? I can get that from my web click data. And can I expose that in a way where I can merge it so that the two actually make some kind of business insight for making a business decision? So really, inside of the APS appliance, we overlay kind of the Microsoft stack on top of Hadoop. So all of the great things that Microsoft has done for the last 20 to 30 years are really something that we can leverage on top of Hadoop. So things like running Active Directory and enabling kind of security models over the top of Hadoop through the creation of external tables, which we'll talk about in a few slides, as well as being able to manage that in a way that's familiar with businesses. So Hadoop is known for just being an open file system. So there's no way really without kind of a lot of administration, and there's not a lot of really tooling around this, to enable you to say, this set of users has access to this set of data, and this set of users has access to this set of data. There's real no management model for that. So we've integrated what we all know and love, Active Directory on top of this, enabled you to just go through and say, I have a set of users, they have access to this set of data. I have a set of users, they have access to this set of data. And I've obscured all the complexity of that away from you. So you don't have to worry about how you manage that. It's through the tools that you know and are familiar with. We partner with a company called Hortonworks. So if you're not familiar with them, they're a distribution of Hadoop. They currently have a platform called the Hortonworks Data Platform. And that's the distribution that Microsoft uses. It's a partnership arrangement between us and Hortonworks. And we use that in the cloud, so you see it in Azure. So it's familiar as HD Insight, and that's what you can run in Azure. We also use that same HD Insight, and it's run inside the appliance. It's the same code base, it's the same set of tools, it's the same team that builds it and integrates it in both places. So we get the advantage of the things we learn in the cloud, and the cloud gets the advantage of the things that we learn in the appliance. One of the other important aspects about any kind of appliance or any kind of data center equipment is the ability to manage and monitor it. So this is an appliance. It has a bunch of servers running in it, has a bunch of network gear running in it, a bunch of disk arrays running in it. So how do you manage and monitor that thing? Well, through the stack that Microsoft has built for years, we've enabled System Center on top of Hadoop. And essentially, you can manage the entire appliance, so you can manage them. You can manage and monitor everything that's happening inside the appliance with a simple management pack that you can get that's specific to the appliance. It can tell you all about what's going on in your system. And finally, again, exposing this data back up through Polybase, through familiar T-SQL constructs, you're able to expose it into Excel, SSRS, or any one of the other reporting tools that are available to your end users. They're able to use the tools that they're familiar with, and you don't have to go learn any one of these new languages or any one of these new tools. You don't have to install anything you've never had to install before and learn. You can use a tool you're familiar with and get access to this data where you can merge what you get from your structured and unstructured data in a way that makes sense to you. So we'll talk a little bit about how the appliance is broken down, and we'll dig into this throughout kind of the talk here. So APS is basically a set of three kind of components. There's the hardware level itself, the physical devices and components within the appliance. There's a fabric layer, which is the management component of the appliance. So we have things like Active Directory within the appliance. We have failover clusterings for high availability, those kinds of things. And that's managed at the fabric layer. And then built on top of those two base components is really what we call regions. There's a parallel data warehouse region, which is scale-out SQL Server. And then ultimately, there's the HD Insight region, which is an option. It's not a required component of the appliance, but it's something that you can purchase on top or as an addition with dedicated servers. And we'll talk about how that all works in a little bit. But really, the HD Insight workload is the second workload being added to, or second region being added to the appliance. As the appliance model grows, you can expect to see additional workloads. But really, what it means is you can segment out parts of the appliance to the different workloads that you're running. So I'll show you what this looks like. And hopefully, my laptop will wake back up. So this is the front end of an appliance. This is actually a virtual appliance. It's not an actual physical component. We use this for demos. So just know that it's not actually a physical set of servers running anywhere. Here at TechEd, if you want to see what a physical server looks like, what a physical appliance looks like, if you see some of the HP folks sitting here, they actually have one of the appliances sitting in their booth. It's a full rack, and it's got a demo of actually what an appliance looks like. You can take a look at the picture. You can kind of look at the physical hardware. But this is the front-end kind of managing component. We call this the administrative center. And essentially what it does is it gives you kind of a quick snapshot view of what the appliance is actually doing. We can look at health data, for example. You can see kind of where the appliance is running. In this case, we're looking at one of the fabric nodes, and it can tell us that there's good health. We can take a quick look at the performance of the appliance. So we can take just a quick real-time. And this is just to give you a quick snapshot. This is if you want to go see what's going on in the appliance. This will take a second to come up. And you can kind of get a view as to just what's happening. You could add different metrics here. There's a bunch of different things to choose from. But it really just gives you a way to look at kind of the overall application of the appliance, how it's working, how you can monitor if something's going wrong, or if you just are curious about how the workload is happening throughout the appliance. But then it breaks down into kind of the individual workloads. So we can start to look into the parallel data warehouse specifically. In this case, you can see that there's a single active query. It actually happens to be, the query that I just completed that was run over here as SSMS was connecting. And you can see what's going on. You can drill into any one of these queries, and you can see the query that was actually run. So you can see the query text. You can see how long it took. The number of concurrency slots, so there's a number of kind of workload slots that you can run a query in. And given the types of loads, you can throttle these or you can add resources to them to give them more availability into the appliance. You can look at some of the other information. You could look at the amount of storage on the appliance, and you can get an idea of how much data is being used. And you can look at your growth. You can look by database size, those kinds of things. As well as then you can look at, if you scroll down, you can look at the HD Insight workload. And so you can see on this particular appliance, we have four nodes. It's a four-node HDI cluster, so it's running on the appliance. You can look at the name node or the file system. You can see I have 125 files. So you can get a basic idea of what's going on in the appliance. You can look at the storage system. Give this a second to come up. You can look at things like the MapReduce jobs that are currently being run. There's a summary of it. Or you can look at the jobs that are being run. Obviously, I'm not running anything now. And these are real-time views as to what's actually happening in the appliance. So you get a quick kind of snapshot. Also on the appliance, since this is HDI or HD Insight, you have the HD Insight front end. And if you've installed HD Insight or the front end to Hadoop, this is the same thing you would see in Azure. So we just happen to be connected to the actual appliance. And you can look things right here on the appliance that you can do in any Hadoop instance. You could create, get myself logged back in here. You can create any one of the front-end jobs. You could create a MapReduce job. You could upload jar files here, particularly if you wanted to, if you've written a MapReduce job in Java, for example. So you have all the front-end kind of Hadoop flexibility that you always have had. We haven't hidden away anything from you. You can still run anything that you want here from a Hadoop perspective outside of even running Polybase or any one of the Microsoft tools. So the question is, do we have a way of looking back at what was run at 2 o'clock in the morning, Weston? Sure, can you see the query or could you see what's happening on the appliance? Sure. So you could do that through a couple of different ways. Through the PDW workspace, you could actually look through it just simply through here, and you could look at the history of jobs that were running at that time, and it'll give you detailed information about each one. Inside the appliance, there's more advanced metrics that you can pull that show you. We have a PDW log specifically. We have a Hadoop log that we pull that shows you exactly what's happening in the appliance at kind of a level of depth below this. So this is more of a summary view. But you can absolutely get to that kind of information. And it's routinely done. People routinely go in and look at that kind of information to optimize. You can look at all the kind of different things. We can go out and look at the name nodes. So here's the front end of Hadoop. We can go in and we can browse the file system of actual Hadoop. So this is standard functionality from Horton. This is not something that's outside the norm of what you could get. You could look at any one of the directories. So we can just kind of scan through here. And you can see just the data that's there. Flip back over to here. So really, that's the basic kind of management model of Hadoop, or of Hadoop and PDW running on the appliance. It's a very simple interface. And again, there's more advanced ways to get at this. You can monitor this whole thing through System Center. You can get at it a bunch of different ways. But really, that's just a quick snapshot of how the appliance is running. So now we're going to kind of pivot a bit, and we're going to talk a little bit about how we connect all this stuff. We're going to talk about Polybase a bit. There was a session earlier this week talking specifically about the depths of Polybase. So if you didn't get a chance to catch that, you can go watch that online after TechEd is done. But it's a great kind of deep dive into Polybase. Here I'm just going to kind of cover the surface a bit, explain the technology, and kind of show you how this thing actually works. So really what we talk about is there's really kind of these two different kind of distinct ways that you can get at data. You have the things that are traditional, so you know the HTTP kind of models or the Hadoop models running out in your environment, whether they're cloud-based or cloud-born or whether they're sitting in your actual environment. And this is pretty common. You'll have customers who said, you know, hey, we implemented Hadoop, and we're throwing all of our log data into there, and we get at it there, but we don't really have a way to merge that with the SQL Server data or the traditional kind of line of business data that we have coming out of our other systems. And so we built this technology called Polybase. And really what it does is it's the ability to basically stream the two sets of data together and then make them make sense in a way that is functional for your business. It's a very flexible system. You have complete control over defining how the data looks and how it gets merged together. So really what the basic model is from an end user's perspective, you write select star from table. And what that does is it'll run through the parallel data warehouse. That's the front end of the Polybase technology. And it runs into Polybase and says, oh, I know that table is an external table, and I need to go get that data from Hadoop. And depending on how that's done, it'll run out to Hadoop, whether it's in, you know, running in Windows Azure up in the cloud, whether it's running in a Hortonworks environment or a Cloudera environment in your own environment, running on Windows or Linux on a bunch of servers that you own, or whether it's in the appliance. You can run it in any one of those places. And it grabs the data. And from there, what it does is it pulls it back into the appliance, and it then puts it into a format that's appropriate for the end result. So in this case, maybe you're running just select star from table out of SSMS, and it just shows you sets of results. If you're running it from Excel, it'll pull it into Excel. So it really gives you the ability to push down a query into these different environments, structured and unstructured, and get at the data the way that you expect. Select star from table is pretty simple. But using this power, we have the ability to do something within an appliance that you don't get outside of an appliance. And one of the things that we have optimized inside of Polybase is the ability to use all of the nodes. So if you can think of an appliance, it's a physical set of servers. So imagine I have a big rack of servers here standing. It would be really loud. That's why I don't have one. And it's got 8 compute nodes running it, so 8 physical servers that run the parallel data warehouse. When you run a query, select star from table, instead of a single node in there reaching out to Hadoop to make the question, so you have 40 nodes of Hadoop sitting over here, we distribute that query across the 8 nodes and make each connection go out and talk to Hadoop and pull in the appropriate data. And we use the power of all of the nodes in the appliance to be able to return that to you very quickly. And I'll show you this in a bit. It's actually a very fascinating technology. But this does enable you to support any way that you have Hadoop in your environment. So if you have Hadoop, again, running in the cloud, you can go get that data. So if you have a lot of cloud-borne data, maybe you happen to have your site running up in the cloud and you have a Hadoop cluster that's logging all of the web traffic right into it in the cloud, you can go grab it from there. And it's not limited to Microsoft's technology. If it's any cloud, your own private cloud, you're enabled to get access to that data as long as it's a Hadoop cluster that we can access. And finally, it gives you the ability to do this over multiple distributions. So one of the limiting factors of some of the Hadoop infrastructure and the support system around it is that they're focused on a specific distribution. So this one only works with Cloudera, or this one only works with Hortonworks. Microsoft is building out the support as wide as we can. Currently, we support Cloudera 4.x, and the HDP 1.0 and 2.0 distributions, or the 2.x distributions. So we can support any one of these technologies. And as those become more mature, we'll support a wider and wider set. We want to be able to enable you to run your business, no matter what technology you've chosen. So we're going to go down a little bit into this. Again, there was a great session earlier this week. You can watch it online on Channel 9 afterwards, and it'll go into a lot of depth about this. But really what we've built is what we call the HDFS bridge. And what it does is it defines a data source and a file format that allows us to basically mimic the data into what looks like a table inside a SQL Server. It's not there. It's similar to the concept of a view, a non-materialized view, where the data is actually just streamed and it's represented to SQL Server as a way that it's familiar with, so in a construct that you're familiar with, like a table with columns and rows. But really, you can define how that's set up, and I'll show you how this is done in a few minutes, but what this enables is it enables what looks like SQL Server, or anything that is connected to what looks like SQL Server, the appliance in this case, the ability to look at data in a table, and it doesn't matter where it came from. It could be a CSV file, it could be a text file, it could be an RC file in the Hadoop world. So it really gives you the ability to go out and get that data in any way that you have it sourced. Here you can see that we've kind of split this slide up to show that, you know, typically this is how this is done. So you have your kind of non-relational data, so things like Twitter feeds or sensor and RFID feeds coming into Hadoop, and your traditional kind of schema-based data warehouse support on the other side, and being able to merge those two and show you how this actually works. So what's really interesting about the way that this works is when we get into environments with customers, this is actually what it typically looks like. Most of the time, they'll say, hey, I've got, you know, SQL Server, SMP, you know, data warehouse running in my environment, and it's pretty big, right? And I have this conversation a lot. How big is big to you? Well, I have, you know, 5 terabytes or 8 terabytes of data here. And I'll say, well, that doesn't really sound that big. Well, I've got this Hadoop cluster that's running 40 nodes, and I have a petabyte over there. And I want to be able to get access to both of those sets of data. How do I do that? And so this is a really common scenario. You have this large set of unstructured data that customers don't really know what to do with. How do I get at it? How do I make sense? How do I join it with my marketing data, my sales data, my CRM data? How do I make sense? And so we have this concept of kind of MapReduce pushdowns. And so essentially what's happening is the technology in Polybase, we have this concept of predicate pushdowns. And the idea is that on the fly, what's happening is that the appliance itself is generating a MapReduce job. It's pushing that out into the Hadoop appliance, or the Hadoop cluster, running the job, getting the aggregated set of data from Hadoop, and returning that to PDW. So we do this completely on the fly. So from an end user's perspective, you don't have to know anything about how MapReduce works. You don't have to know what the technology is, and we have a converter that takes our information and converts it over to Java and creates the jars and pushes them into Hadoop. And it's very high performant. It allows Hadoop to be able to manage across its infrastructure at its optimal level and return that data back to PDW in a way that makes sense to allow it to optimize. And then we expose that again back to everything that you're familiar with. It looks like T-SQL. It returns results in the way that typical SQL Server would. This was all pioneered out of the Gray Systems Lab, which is run by Dr. DeWitt at the University of Wisconsin in Madison. And it's a technology that's been kind of worked on for several years. They spent a lot of time really thinking about how to do this in a way that's performant, which at data warehousing scale, when we're talking about hundreds of billions of rows or quadrillion rows, which is a very large number, which we actually have in an environment where, you know, and I'll get this wrong, it's a one with either 18 or 21 zeros behind it as a number of rows in a single table, then connected to a 100 terabyte Hadoop infrastructure that's growing at the rate of about 5 terabytes a day at this point. So being able to merge those things in a way that's optimally performant in both environments is something that's a lot of time has been spent really optimizing how this model works. So I'll show you what this looks like. So traditionally what you'd do is you'd write a simple query, select user product sentiment from Twitter data, right? And then you put some where clauses around it. And really what Polybase is doing is the first thing it'll do is it'll do a dynamic bind to the actual infrastructure in Hadoop. And again, going back to that concept of Hadoop being a file system, it's just a file sitting somewhere. And so it's going to say, these are the files that I'm going to go connect to, and it's going to make that automatic connection as the first kind of dynamic binding component of Polybase. The second thing it's going to do is then it's going to filter down. It's going to only return the results based on the column that it's looking for. It's not actually going to pull all of them back out of Hadoop, and we do this for optimal performance. And finally, it'll run its where clause against that data and find the sets of data that actually are supposed to be returned. And we'll do this on the Hadoop side, so we don't incur any network traffic or any boundary issues around pushing a lot of data back and forth between the systems. It really optimizes the way the two work together. So really, there's kind of this enhanced kind of compatibility and ease of use with Polybase. It allows you to do all of the things that we've kind of talked about, managing over the top with security and permissions, being able to expose data in a way that has not made sense to users before. How do I run Scoop? How do I install this thing? What's a pig job? What's Hive mean? It's really confusing a lot of times trying to keep up with this technology. So we've really kind of taken away some of the complexity of that. We have support for text files, RC files, comma separated value files, the ability to kind of define what your source data is and mimic to that and not have to define a structure on you. So we don't say, your text file is fine, but it has to look exactly like this or it doesn't work. It's quite the opposite. It could be in any format that works for your business, and then you just have to set up a structure that understands it. And I'll show you that in just a minute. And finally, the ability to work into Azure. So the ability to go to cloud-borne data. Be able to move across what's being born locally in an environment, so whether it's in your data center, whether it's in your under your desk, or whether it's something that's being born out of the cloud. Microsoft obviously has a big push, as well as many other vendors, to get you to the cloud and take advantage of the economies of scale there. But still getting at that data is something that's really important. So if you had 100 terabytes of data running in the cloud, pulling that down to your local environment in order to do some analytics just blows out of the water the ability to do anything that looks like real time. Just moving 100 terabytes of data around is really, really difficult over a network. So really this kind of comes back to what's the real use case. So you have a bunch of different users. Some of them are, depending on what your environment is, you'll have data scientists, and they're really kind of into the weeds of the technologies, and they're really into the weeds of understanding how things work. So we traditionally think of these as like, the researcher doing DNA research, or the researcher doing polio vaccine research, or cancer research, and they're really looking at kind of advanced models down in the weeds inside these technologies. But really, you start to back away from what's typical inside of a company. You have power users that are sitting at their desk, and they're running kind of advanced analytics on their own. They're running, very kind of complex queries against the environment, and they're trying to understand some data. But most often what you have is you have a bunch of folks sitting at their desk saying, hey, I've got to get a report out to my boss that shows, what the trend is around this sale, or what the trend is around kind of the inventory management inside of our company and how we can optimize that. And exposing those back to the data back to ways that people are really familiar with. And that's really the bulk of the audience. So I'm going to walk you through a little bit of code just here so you have a little concept of what I'm about to show you in a demo. But really the way that this all works through Polybase is the ability to create this concept of a table. It's no different than you've ever seen in any other system. So create table. And it has the ability to define columns and column types. But really, the only thing that we've added in APS, or in the parallel data warehouse side, is this concept of kind of the with clause. And in here, it defines a couple of things. The first is a data source. And this really references where you're going to get the data from. The second is the file format. So what is the format of those files? How are you going to get it? Is my Twitter feed exactly the same as my sensor data feed? Probably not. And so if you want to have a table that shows me, show me all my Twitter data, I'll set it up one way. And if I want to have another table that says, show me all my sensor data, I'll set it up a little differently. The third command is really the location. Where does that data exist? So in this case, we're talking about Hadoop or the back end of the Azure Blob Store. And so where does it live? Give me the location of it. And finally, we have an optional parameter for reject values. So these are things like, how often do you want me to sense in the data that something is wrong with the data? So there's bad data, and can I have some control over that? So do I pull all that data in and just say, well, I have a 5% failure rate because the data coming in is a little dirty. Is that acceptable or not? You have complete control over that. And you could say, I want zero bad data. So if it doesn't work, it doesn't work. And you can go out and fix the data, or it could define for you where the data is wrong. And I'll break these down a little bit because they're a little more complex than just a simple line. So in this case, we're looking at an external data source. And it's really kind of two options, or two parameters, with the third as an optional. The first is the type of data. So currently, this is only supported as Hadoop, as an external data. And that doesn't matter whether it's Windows Azure Blob Store, or whether it's Hadoop running on the appliance, in your environment, or in the cloud. The second is the actual location. So this is the cluster information about where the Hadoop cluster lives. So again, it could be anywhere. It doesn't have to be on the appliance. And then finally, an optional job tracker location. So this is the master controller in the Hadoop cluster for being able to push MapReduce jobs and the management of that inside of a Hadoop cluster. And then we talked about file formats. So really, a file format is based out of kind of the definition of what the file is that you're getting data from. The first one is really the type of source, so delimited text file, RC file, if you're familiar with those in the Hadoop world. And then some other kind of optional parameters. So a serialization model, so how you would serialize data or deserialize data coming kind of back and forth between Hadoop and PDW. The compression model, so you could use gzip or things like that to compress the data in Hadoop. So if you're pushing data down into Hadoop, then you have the ability to control how big of the data is. Do you want to zip it first so you can kind of save size on the Hadoop side? And then finally, some format options, and I'll show you what these are. So really, you have the ability to define what that file is. Now, I know this seems like a lot, but I'll show you this very quickly in a couple minutes, and you'll see that it's actually really easy. So you could say, hey, my row terminator is a return line, or it's a pipe, or it's whatever it is, and you can define out, you know, all the different parameters so that you can get access and you have this flexibility of getting the data from all these different systems. So let's talk about kind of the use cases of Polybase. So what do people do with this? So this is a technology we've had for a while, and we can talk about kind of why people would do this. The first is, I'm a customer, and I have a great reference for you. We have a customer who, they say, hey, I really have 5 terabytes of structured data, and I have 1.6 petabytes of unstructured data. How do I get at this? And what we've told them is, using Polybase and through the front end of PDW, you're able to go out into that Hadoop data and make sense of it. You can get insight out of it, but you don't actually have to move any of it. It all sits there, and you can pull at it at any way that you want. You can expose tables. You can permission those tables appropriately. So these folks can see the HR data, and these folks can see sales data, and these folks can see marketing data, and my social team can see all our social analytics. So we're really able to do that in a performant way. Running against almost 2 petabytes is never going to be fast. And so we've shown them how through Polybase, you can actually optimize that and use the power of both Polybase and computational nodes running in a parallel environment and do that against a very large 40, 45 node cluster and actually make it fairly fast. You'd be surprised at how quickly you can get insight out of 2 petabytes of data. The next one is really archiving data warehouse to Hadoop. We call this the cold store model. And really, if you think about traditional data warehousing models, you have, you know, very large SQL Server data warehouses, and what you do is you end up with data that's kind of cold data. So, hey, nobody really is looking at, you know, what happened 5 years ago in my sales team. Like, what did we sell 5 years ago? Well, sometimes you want to keep that around for historical reasons, but really what you're doing is you're keeping that down for looking at historical trends and starting to gain insights about kind of, you know, year-over-year kind of models where you say, oh, you know, right around Christmas time, we start to sell a lot of electronics. So you want to see what that trend looks like year out over year. But you don't really want to have access to it all the time, or you don't necessarily need to. Storing things in high-performance environments, even APS or some of the other vendors, is really expensive. And so cloud-borne models or Hadoop models where you can run into very cheap, very kind of commoditized hardware allows you to push that data out into what we call a cold store model. So you can take every piece of data that you had for the last year and shove it out into Hadoop, run it up in Windows Azure, and you can do it for pennies on the dollar that you could if you bought the physical hardware yourself to store it. And this allows you both to get at the data when you need it, say you're going to do historical trend analysis, but it's not incurring the cost that you would if you had to build out a complete storage infrastructure inside of your environment. The next one is really kind of exporting, so taking a copy of what we have in PDW and exposing it to Hadoop. This is a less common scenario, but it does occur. People have built infrastructure around Hadoop, and so we're not limiting you to say, well, you have the structured data in PDW, and you can't get at it other than through PDW. We're giving you the ability to push the data around wherever it makes the most sense. Maybe you have data that's very small in your structured world, relatively, and you want to push it out into Hadoop so that you can optimize the way that Hadoop can work. So, for example, that same customer that has 8 terabytes of structured data versus almost, you know, 2 petabytes, 1.6, 1.7 petabytes of data, you really want to optimize for where the computational power and where the data lives instead of forcing all that data into parallel data warehouse and trying to compute it there. Again, moving, you know, 1.6, 1.7 petabytes of data around is not the most trivial thing. It really pushes the bounds of networks. So you want to optimize in your environment from where the data lives and not push it into one model or the other. And then finally, the ability to take data out of Hadoop and push it into PDW. So you may have data that you get out of sensor information and you're aggregating in that in a way, and you want to put it into your data warehouse for near real-time analytics. This is something that's quite common where people say, I'm going to go aggregate my Twitter data, I'm going to get some sentiment value out of that, and I want to take that aggregation and I want to put it into my data warehouse so that my front-end users have access to it. They can see what kind of sentiment's happening over time, for example. So instead of talking about it, I'll show you. I like to show demos, and they're a lot more fun than me just explaining what they are. So we're going to use a simple one of our demos here, the cybercrime data. And this actually is real data. The actual data here is kind of a snapshot from December of last year. And this has come out of the digital crime units at Microsoft. So what they do is they go out and they look at infections in PCs kind of across the world, and they help take down botnets. So they've done this in the last couple of years. You've seen some press about that. So the first thing we're going to do is we're going to look on the appliance, and you can see that I have the ability to configure kind of a couple different ways of results. So you can see in this case, there's a server configuration that says what kind of Hadoop instance am I going to connect to, and you can see we support a bunch of different ones. At this point, you can see that my config value is 1, so I'm connecting to HTTP running on the appliance as well as in the cloud. And then we'll go create that external data source. So the first thing we'll do is we'll create a data source, and I want to point out a couple things that are here. So you can see that we're calling out as a Hadoop type. And then we have a location, and this happens to be the head node or the head node of the cluster of Hadoop running on this particular appliance. And then you can see I'm also using the job tracker for being able to do pushdown predicate kind of queries. So this is the ability to push down a MapReduce job. And it's a simple execution. And this will just return. And there's a metadata view that comes with it. So if you always wanted to see what data sources you have combined inside of PDW, you have just a quick query to go show you, and it tells you all the information about it. The second thing we'll do is we'll create some file formats. So we'll create a simple one here. This first one's a delimited text. It's pipe delimited, pretty common file format. And I've given it a very simple date model. So just month, month, day, day, and year, year. So very simple, and I can just run that. And that creates the file format. And I'll create another one here. We'll create a comma-separated value ones. Pretty similar. The only difference is, in this case, I'm running just a comma instead of a pipe delimiter. So we'll go ahead and create that. And again, there's another new dynamic management view that you can go take a look at, and you can actually see, hey, there's my two file formats. Gives you all the information about it. Again, there's some optionals here. You can see that in this case, I'm not doing data compression, or I'm not doing any serialization method. It'll use kind of the default environment for those. But you get the information about what it is. So now let's go into one of the actual tables. We have a table called Sinkhole. And this is actually where the data runs. This is basically a wide table that has incident data, has the type of infection, those kinds of things. So it's a traditional kind of fact table that you would see in a data warehouse load. It's got about 1 million rows in here. I didn't pull all the data. I just did something quick for this demo so you can get kind of an idea what it is. And you can kind of see, you know, just doing a quick, oops, wrong button. You can see doing a quick aggregation. The results coming back are going to be something simple. Right? I just did an aggregation by date and the number of incidences that were counted on that date. Again, this is a bit of contrived data. This isn't actually the real data, but it gives you an idea of what's in there. So if we wanted to do something interesting, you'll see that I'm going to go out and I'm going to ask for Hadoop to return me a table that's coming out of a comma-separated values file. So if we go back out to Hadoop and we look in our cybercrime folder, you'll see a file called sinkhole CSV. We'll wait for this to load. It'll take a second here. And you can see it's about 2 megs. It's not really a very big file. And what I've done is I've taken data from 2012 from a particular day, and I've shoved it out here in a comma-separated value file. So here's the view of it. So you can see, you know, it's just a set of columns, some data. And what I'm going to ask PDW to do is I'm going to ask PDW to create a table called sinkhole with a particular date and create a set of columns, something I'm very familiar with. So I'm going to go ahead and execute this. You'll see that PDW just created a table. And if I go run a quick query on this, I'm going to just run a count. And what just happened, I know it seems like I just hit count. Oops. And I'll show you the results here. I hit count, and what it did was it just said, oh, I've got 31,000 rows. I'm going to explain the complexity of what just happened. From my laptop, it sent a query out to PDW. PDW interpreted that and said, oh, I've got to go to Hadoop. In this case, it took that query, created a MapReduce job, pushed that down to Hadoop, ran the job, said, give me all the rows in that Excel file, pulled it back into PDW, and returned it to my laptop. And it did that in, you know, sub-second. Right? This was as fast as I could be. And I can run it again here if you want to see. It did all of that work in the time it took to actually respond here. And again, this is a very contrived example. It's actually a small set of rows, and so you would expect it to be fast. Yes? So the question is that when I created the table, it was actually created in PDW. Yes, the representation of the table is stored in PDW. At this point, Hadoop knows nothing about that create table. If you want to think of it as something similar to like a non-materialized view, it's very similar to that concept where it's a definition of a structure, but there's no data that's present like on disk. And so it asks for the data on demand, only when it's executed. Yeah? Does SQL Server cache the queries from external tables? Does So the question is really, how are we caching the data? So if I ran this over and over and over again, is it, in this case particularly, no. We make an assumption that, the data potentially is live in the other system, so we have no idea whether it's cached or not, or whether it's changed or not, so we have no caching model within Polybase. So now that we've done that, we've created a table from Excel, let's go and try this a different way. So what we're going to do is we're actually going to create another external table, but we're going to do it from data that already exists on top of PDW. So this happens to be the sinkhole data, and I'm doing a simple kind of, you know, very similar data model, so it looks just like the table that we already had. And you can see I'm just going to filter out on a date. And in this case, I'm actually going to go out and create the data in this table. And so I'm just going to take this, I'll highlight this out. And what this just did was it grabbed 30,000 rows or so out of PDW, generated a MapReduce job, and pushed this out into Hadoop. And so it just shoved all this data out into Hadoop. It gives me that ability to move data from my hot system, in this case PDW, out into Hadoop. So I had a very simple way of moving the data around in my environment. I didn't have to go create an ETL job. I didn't have to go get, you know, crack open SSIS. I did it simply with T-SQL. I said, here's my data, and I want to put it over there. I could then go delete it out of PDW and do a join later on if I wanted to for historical reasons. So you can see if I go out and I do just a quick query, again, I took that data out of PDW and I put it out into Hadoop. So you can see, in this case, I've run it a couple times this morning, so you can see it's now shoved that data out twice. In this case, I'm doing an aggregation out. I didn't tell it to go recreate. So now let's do something fun. So now that I've got that data in PDW that's coming from a CSV file, and I've got the data that I just pushed out into Hadoop, again, none of this is now going to be running in a materialized way on PDW, I can create a view. Let's just make a simple one here. And I'm going to go out. This first one is the data that's I just pushed into Hadoop. That's this 2013 model. And you can see here's the 2012 model that I pulled out of the CSV. So if I just create this simple view and then execute it, what just occurred is that PDW is now going to run out. Oops, I'll show you the results here. So PDW run out. It created a Polybase query. It executed against those two tables inside of what is now Hadoop, ran two MapReduce jobs, returned that results to PDW, aggregated the results, and returned it to you very quickly. So now as an end user, I don't have to know anything about how Hadoop works. I can just write a simple construct. Hey, I've got two tables, and I just want to join them and merge them in a way that makes sense. I could put them in any star model. I could do joins against them. I could push data around in any way that I'm very familiar with. I can expose this in Excel if I wanted to. So since I was talking about that, let's do that. So this is the APS demo is actually the blob store running up in Azure. And you can see I now just created an external data source that's connecting up to Azure. And if I go out and I look, you'll see I now have two data sources. I have one that's my local HDI cluster, and I have another one that's actually the blob store running in Windows Azure. So if I go take that data and I say, hey, what if I wanted to create some data from the cloud? And I happen to actually have the Azure Storage Explorer, and this is connected to the account that's running in Azure. So you can see I've got a file here called files tech-ed. It's a simple file. It's a pipe delimited file. And if I run that, I can go ahead and create an external table out of that. And if I happen to run, you know, a query out of that, I can see that, hey, here's a list of all the tech-eds that have been ever held, what year they were held, what city and what state they were held in. And that's all fascinating, but, you know, nobody really cares about writing those kinds of queries. So let's do something fun with it. So we could take this, and I've got a connection out to that database, and it's going to prompt me for a password here. And I'll go ahead and I'll connect, and let's go find that tech ed table. So I can pull it into Excel. I'll just create a simple table. All right. And so what this is doing is it's now creating a query into PDW that's going out to Azure, reading the file, pulling the data back out of Hadoop onto PDW, and exposing it to Excel. It's now a simple table in Excel. But I can do some fun stuff with this. If you guys haven't had a chance to see PowerMap this week, we'll just shove this up in a PowerMap. I'm curious as to where all these are and kind of what they look like. Again, this is kind of simple data. Hold on, we're going to wait for PowerMap. I can see the hard drive on my laptop spinning. But it's simple data, right? It's something that you've seen before, and we can say, hey, you know, here's PowerMap. And I can take this data and I can say, hey, let's do like a quick count of years. So let's count, not blank. How many years, right? And so there's my data exposed on a map. And I can refresh the data from here, and you'll see, hey, where's Houston, right? We're here. What happened? So if I go out to Hadoop, running in the cloud, in this case, I'm just going to open the file up, and I can run a quick addition. So I say, oops, I forgot Houston, Texas. Right, save the file. I'll get prompted to save the file in Hadoop, running up in Azure. So I've now saved the file. If I go back to Excel, all I have to do from Excel, Excel's doing weird things for me, is just run a simple refresh. And the thing that you'll notice is all of a sudden Houston just showed up. So whether that data was born in PDW or whether it was born and updated somewhere else, I have the ability to pull it into Excel like I'm familiar with. So I could go back to my Power Map, run a quick refresh, and all of a sudden we'll see, hey, there's Houston, and there's us. Right? So I have the ability to use the tools that I'm familiar with, Excel, Power Pivot, Power Query, all those, when I'm actually running against Hadoop data running in the cloud. And it's completely abstracted away from the user. Gives them the ability to get the data no matter where it resides. So now let's talk about kind of performance at scale. So PDW is really kind of focused on traditional data warehousing models. So if we talk about the scale-out SQL server side, one of the traditional problems that have always been enabled in kind of SMP data warehouses has been the ability to scale up. What happens when I stick a petabyte of data in SQL server? What's going to happen? How big of an environment do I have to build for that? I'm going to end up with a really massive server with a really large SAN behind it in order to scale up. And we call this the forklift model. It's been talked about for years. If I want to make that thing bigger, I just get a bigger server, and I keep growing that thing until, you know, I run out of money, essentially, is typically what happens. The other side of it is the way that the data is stored. So traditionally, inside of data warehouses, and even in kind of OLTP systems, things are stored at a row level. So you store a continuous row that says, you know, here's the ID, here's the first name, here's the last name of the user, and some information about them. But in data warehousing models, typically you never pull that across. You have a very wide table that has all kinds of information about an order. You'll have, you know, return values and all these things that essentially you're never going to pull into, you know, particular queries. And so that row model has really kind of caused a problem. You're having to pull all of this large sets of data when in reality you're only using a very small component of it in order to satisfy the question that's being asked. And so the way that, PDW works is it has a scale-up model split across kind of a computational component or a computational architecture. And what this means is that you have multiple nodes with dedicated CPU, memory, and hardware that are focused on small jobs. So a very similar model to the way that Hadoop's evolved. And what this means is that you can take cheaper commodity-level hardware and run workloads that are massively bigger than anything you could in a single SMP environment. You have the ability to add hardware to scale out, so you could start very small. And as your business grows, you add just additional compute nodes to what looks like a virtual single server. And so you have the ability to say, well, I don't need to go buy a $5 million piece of hardware. I can add smaller chunks of hardware and really grow this thing out. You can get into 60 node configurations running 6 petabytes of data on a single appliance in PDW only. You could then mimic that into a Hadoop section of that same appliance running another 60 sets of nodes, running another 12 petabytes of data of Hadoop data in a single instance. So what I was doing in SQL Server Management Studio, querying across that, you could have access to 18 petabytes of data with 120 nodes that looks like a single instance to an end user. They have no idea what's running behind it. It's all completely managed in the appliance model. You have the ability to basically scale up either one of those. So again, you could start with a very small PDW. This is actually a common case where you have a very small PDW and you start there because you really don't have that much structured data. Generating petabytes of structured data is actually really hard to do. Most companies don't have that level of data. But you do from things like Twitter and the web traffic that you're generating or the sensor data that you find in cars these days. So the ability to be able to take all that data and shove it into a system, you can scale out as your business needs. Not you have to scale out as equal and equal. You have to have as much PDW as you do Hadoop. You can have very small PDW and very large Hadoop, or vice versa, very large PDW and very large or very small Hadoop. And so what does this all add up to? And this is the slide that everybody loves. You talk about kind of column store representation and how column store really is enabling you to look at data in a way that you didn't. So if I wanted to pull, you know, order history from all of the customers I've ever had, I don't necessarily want to go get what date it was ordered on and all that kind of thing. I maybe want to do it by category. And so I'm only going to pull the columns back out of SQL Server in this case in a way that makes sense. That means that the performance of that system is significantly faster. And using the kind of the parallel query execution, you take a single query, you run it across multiple nodes, and you allow them to execute in parallel, and aggregate results. And this can result in massive, massive performance improvements. In a recent case study that we had done with one of our customers, we took a quarterly sales report. I did weekly, monthly, quarterly sales, and they would aggregate that up in SQL Server Data Warehouse in a simple SMP environment. It was a fairly large SQL Server system, and they asked us to do a quick proof on how fast we could duplicate that exact environment in PDW. Again, it was a very large SQL SMP environment. We took it and put it on a two-node, what we call a quarter rack, PDW environment. Their traditional query, it took about 13 and a half hours. When we took that same query and did nothing for optimizing against MPP, we took that query from 13 hours to 39 minutes. When we optimized against MPP, really using the power of all of the nodes and doing some of the things that we can do in an appliance, it went to 3 minutes. We took that same thing and we said, well, hey, we're just playing around. We'll take it and we'll put it on a quarter rack. And it went from 3 minutes to a minute and a half. And they realized the power of what an appliance can do. Using kind of scale-out computational power, we were able to take the appliance and really push it into a way that all of a sudden they started asking questions they'd never asked before. Well, we know at the end of the month we're going to run this report and it takes 13 hours, so you know on Monday we'll have it sitting on our desk. And what they realized was very quickly was that they could have a report every hour if they wanted. They could have real near-time data from their perspective as to what's going on in their business every single day. And their executives' eyes opened up and they said, wow, this enables us to do so many things about our business we never could before. Another great example is we have a lot of customers who use the power of loading. So we talk about kind of load cycles. There's a customer case where the customer is a claims processor for health insurance. So they get once a day, they get a large set of claims out of SAP, and it says, here's all the data that I have. You have to go process this. And they have a required SLA from the regulatory bodies that they work with to be able to turn that around. And they have a very large SQL SMP environment. And using the power of the appliance, what they did was they were able to take, you know, what they essentially push is about a terabyte of data into the system every day, and then they have to turn around aggregations and do that in 4 hours and deliver that to another system. They took that same environment, again, on a quarter rack environment, not even something very large, and they were able to take that from 4 hours to 10 minutes by doing essentially nothing, taking the data and pointing it at a different system. And they used it because the power of the appliance is being able to distribute that load, the loading of the data, and the aggregation of the data across multiple nodes and do it in a way that allows you to scale very quickly. In that case, the customer ultimately purchased a half-rack appliance, and they can do that same workload that it was taking them 4 hours, and they can do it under 5 minutes. And so they have no problems meeting their qualifications, and they've started exploring, now that they have this data and they can do something with it, what they can do to improve the process for the claims process that they have. And improve the experience for ultimately the customer that's having their claims processed for their healthcare. So a little bit about ColumnStar specifically. It's focused on kind of two different things. So if you think about, this is a bit in the weeds, so I'll try to keep it a little higher level here because this is a 200 level talk. But really essentially, if you think about the way that the data is stored inside of a database, you essentially store row data, and that gets stored on pages. Cluster and column index flips that on its head. It says we're now going to store it in a column-based representation. So we get the obvious advantage of being able to compress data that's specific to a specific data type. So if you think about something like ints, for example, right? If you had a column full of ints, but you had a very wide table full of char data, being able to compress all those different data types is actually very difficult. So if you could take that and turn it on its head and say, oh, I have just a bunch of numbers. Can I compress that in a way that makes sense based on the values of those numbers? And you can. And that's the concept of CCI. So not only do you get the ability to rapidly return data in a data warehousing example, if that column, say, has 100 billion rows in it, you can only pull that one column instead of pulling 100 billion rows by however wide your table is. You can pull that very quickly. You also get this ability to compress. We are currently in the process of working with a couple customers and converting them to CCI. And some of their very kind of wide tables, we've seen anywhere from 5x to 300x compression savings on their tables. And so you can shove more data onto smaller sizes, smaller footprints, less things to go wrong in an appliance, hardware breaks, less management, less monitoring, less maintenance, less cost. Right? So we're able to give them the workloads that they had before with less infrastructure and give them the ability to push more data in and to get more insight out of their systems. Finally, we're going to talk about kind of distributed parallel query execution. We kind of showed this a little bit in kind of the way that this works. So essentially, it's a model that's been around for a while. So you have the ability from a client perspective to execute a query, There's a concept of a control node, and it distributes that query out. It creates an execution plan, and it pushes across all of the compute nodes. And in PDW, essentially, this means the more compute nodes you have, the wider your parallelism, the faster your query runs. And this is a near linear scale. So 4 is faster than 2 at a scale of 2x. 8 is faster than 2 by a scale of 4x. It's literally a linear scale. So if we were to put a chart up, it would just 45-degree angle going straight up. That's what it looks like. And then kind of concurrency. So one of the things about appliances and data warehousing loads is that you always end up in these situations where, well, nobody can touch the data because we're loading. That's always a constant problem. And if you talk about loading very large data sets, 1 terabyte, 2 terabyte, 5 terabytes, 10 terabytes a day, that can take a significant amount of time. So you have users who can't have access to other data because something else is going on. APS solves this by concurrency models and throttling. So you're able to allocate resources to different types of loads on the system. So you can have traditional ETL, ELT loads through SSIS or MDS or other models. We have a tool called DW Loader, which is an optimized loader. It can run at very high speeds. It can outrun pretty much every other technology on the market. On a 20-node system, we've been able to push somewhere in the 9.5 to 10 terabytes range of data per hour into the appliance. So very large volumes of data into the appliance very quickly. And you can push it into different types. So you can see you can push it into column store, you can push it into traditional heap tables or any of the types of tables. Through Hadoop tables, you can actually go through Polybase and be able to load. And so you can throttle each one of these things independently. So if you have a lot of users you have one big load job a day and then you want to optimize for all the different other types of activity on the appliance, you can do that. And then on the other side, the ability to push data out of the appliance into additional models like SQL SMP for additional analysis in SSAS or DataMart, so you can push data out into individual kind of components of your business. Reporting in cubes, so ROLAP and MOLAP cubes, being able to access the data directly into PDW. And finally, the traditional BI tools that we're familiar with, Excel and SQL reporting services, as well as the Tableaus and the MicroStrategies and those other technologies outside of Microsoft. So finally, we'll talk about kind of the engineered value. So really, one of the things that Microsoft has done has walked into this model, into the appliance game, and we've really only been in this business for the last 5 years or so. And in that way, we've kind of come in late, right? The Oracles of the world, the Teradatas of the world, they've been around for quite a long time. They've been doing this for a lot longer than we have. But we came in with kind of two different thoughts. One is, how do we take what's traditionally a very expensive system and how do we make it very inexpensive? How do we make it so that this technology is available to everybody? And we did this two ways. We made some smart architectural decisions, and we ended up with having the lowest price per terabyte of any appliance on the market. So we can compete with anybody on price any day of the week. And we do that by making some smart decisions. We have optimized costs. We have optimized structure in the appliance. But the biggest thing that we've done that the other vendors haven't is we use commodity hardware. You can go look at one of our appliances. You can realize that these are components that you can pick off any shelf off of any one of our vendors. Again, you can walk into the HP booth later today, and you can see what this looks like. It's one of their standard rack servers, specifically. Yeah?
Do you consider SAP and Hadoop to be a competitor on your competitive side or on the client side?
Both. We do consider, to repeat the question for the microphones, do we consider SAP HANA a competitor on the database side or on the appliance side? It's actually considered in both, and both teams inside of Microsoft look at them as a competitor. So. And they do stack up. They're a competitive offer. They have a lot of good tooling. So we're not shy about our competitors. It's a great business to be in. It's a lot of fun, actually, to see what other people are doing and how we can take the advantages of what we have inside of Microsoft and go compete. So we do compete with them quite often. But back to what I was saying. Some of the things about kind of storage and the way that we run this. We use storage spaces, for example, to use clustered shared volumes. So in our environment, we have, instead of SANs, we just use JBODs, which is just a bunch of disks. Each one of our scale unit is 48 disks sitting in an array, and we use clustered shared volumes to expose them to all of the nodes in the appliance. So really what this means is we spend a lot of time talking to HP. There's a couple of folks in HP here in the room that I know I speak to quite often through email and as well as my team and the folks I work with. But we optimize both on what we can do from a Microsoft perspective as well as what the hardware vendors can do. We look at the capabilities of each one of the components and we try to find ways that we can make the appliance faster as well as making it cheaper at the same time. How do we learn from what the IHVs are doing in the field? They have vast experience on deploying large systems for customers at all kinds of different scale. and they can provide that knowledge into the appliance. We do a lot of co-engineering on the design of our systems with our hardware vendors so that they can tell us, hey, you know, if you really optimize this way, or we see these kinds of things in the field, and these are the optimizations you can make, let's push those into the appliance, and we can get the best practices not only from just Microsoft's perspective, but from the hardware vendor's perspective. And it gives us a wider view as to what's actually happening in the world. So I'll show you what one of these looks like in a picture. Really, the way that a rack would look like is you start at the top with kind of redundant networks for InfiniBand and Ethernet. And so the InfiniBand is a high-speed, if you're not familiar with it, it's a high-speed information network. Runs up to 56 gigs a second or something like that. And we'll use that for large data movement within the appliance, so as we move stuff around. And then we'll start with the compute nodes for PDW. Essentially, we start with kind of what we call the region or the fabric we were talking about before. So this is the basic management of the appliance. And then a scale unit at the bottom. So it's a couple compute nodes with some storage attached to it. And if we wanted to scale, in this case, we'll scale up to HDI. So we're going to shove an HDI region here. In this case, what you see is we've added two additional what we call compute nodes. It's a set of servers and storage attached, as well as kind of management nodes. So this is the management of HDI, so the typical kind of head nodes and management nodes that you would see in a cluster. And as we blow this out, we can add a second rack. And we could say, hey, what would a second rack look like if we had a multi-rack appliance? We do have multiples of these out in the wild. And so, again, you end up with redundant information on the top, the InfiniBand networks and the Ethernet networks for the rack, and they're interconnected together to make what looks like a single virtual server. And again, we start with the storage unit, so we can continue to add and scale out the appliance, so however big you would like this to be. And what you see over here is kind of the management of how this is done. So we have this concept of kind of active units of work. And these are things that we manage in the appliance. So these would be things like the failover clustering that happens in the appliance, the ability to keep the appliance up and running in failure scenarios, so high availability in the appliance. And we have the concept of what we call a passive unit, and that's a passive single server that can handle any load in the appliance. So if one of the compute node fails, it can fail over to this backup node, and the appliance continues to run using Windows failover clustering and live migration of VMs. And then, you know, really kind of talking about the ability to expand this. So we have failover nodes as a default. We typically have one out of the box, so you have a single kind of failover node. But you have options. If you'd like a bigger failover set, you have options to be able to add additional failover nodes. And that allows you to fail over multiple times if something really goes wrong in the appliance, to keep the appliance up. And then we can talk about kind of really the way that the architecture is built. So we use kind of the technologies that we have available at our hands here at Microsoft, and we kind of start with what we call like a host layer. I'm getting a little bit into the architecture here. And really what this is a physical server sitting on the bottom. And the servers then tell us, hey, you know, here's how we manage kind of the infrastructure in the fabric. And laid over the top of that is the compute infrastructure, so the VMs. This is really kind of the power of what those regions were we were talking about. And so when we have failovers, you can see kind of data being moved around. So, you know, nodes can push onto any one of the failover nodes, and you're able to move things in and out. The last couple things I'm going to show you are security enhancements. So in AU1, the current release of the product, we have the ability to do integrated authentication and transparent data encryption. I'm running out of time here, so I'm going to slide through these kind of quickly. But really, this is the ability to administer the users in the appliance, again, across PDW as well as NT or across Hadoop, using, you know, just standard Active Directory. So it has kind of a failover model back to traditional kind of through Kerberos and then back to NTLM. And if those don't fail, then you actually get booted out. But it doesn't require trust. So you can use the domain inside the appliance, or you can actually integrate it across the domains that you have. And you could have an existing corporate domain, and you can use that domain to actually integrate through. And then TDD. So TDD is really the ability to encrypt data on the appliance. So you have the ability to control all of the structure of the data. You can create master keys, you can create certificates, and you have the ability to manage who has access to the data at the physical layer. I was going to show you a demo of this, but we're a little out of time. And it's really just T-SQL code to show you actually how to integrate that. If you have any more questions about APS, we have a great site that can talk about APS, the appliance, and I can take probably make one or two questions if there's any last questions before we end. Cool. All right. At the end of these, I'm supposed to tell you there's an evaluation to enter. If you can enter the evaluation, Microsoft is donating a dollar for every evaluation that they get to local charity. So if you're interested in taking an evaluation of this session, it's great feedback for me on things that I can learn on how to present a little better, but it's also a great opportunity to help the community. Thank you for your time this morning, and if you have any questions, I'll be available after.